This is Photo Geek Weekly, episode 39. We're recording this on September 27th of 2018. And this is a really important episode because this is coinciding with the week of Photokina. So tons of geeky and just photographically interesting topics for us to bring to you today. And in the co-pilot seat with me today is Steve Brokaw. Steve, you were on, it was a long time ago. I think episode 8 or 9.
Right.
And it's great to have you back in the fray. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing great. It's been a really exciting summer. I've gotten a lot done and getting ready for fall. So I'm really looking forward to it.
So when you say you've gotten a lot done, I mean, what are you doing? What is your day job?
Actually, I'm a professional photographer now. I retired from corporate life after doing that for 30 some odd years, and now focusing almost exclusively on studio work, my studio, and photography. So I'm really enjoying it.
Congratulations, by the way. Yeah. I know how difficult that transition is to make. I did that transition while I was still living in my mom's place. And so I had a year of time before my wife and I were going to move in together. She was my fiance at the time. And I figured, okay, if I can make a go at this,
right,
I have a year where I have fairly minimal payments on things. There's no mortgage or rent or anything that I have to put into. The electricity and everything else is covered. So if I could put in the 100-hour weeks right now and make a go at it, then I might have a chance of success. This is my narrow window. And Here I am. I was able to make that work. But the transition you made would have been much more difficult.
It was. But, you know, the nice thing was is that I had made my money, I guess we'll say, in the corporate life. And I had transitioned into photography over the last 10 years. And so the transition was pretty smooth. I mean, I literally stopped one day working and started working in the photography side. And it gives me the ability to choose the jobs that I want and pass on the jobs that I don't want. And, I'm not doing it because this is my, I don't have to pay the bills with it completely. So it really works out nicely.
And what industry are you in? Because it's different from mine entirely.
Yeah. I mean, from a photography standpoint?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm what I would say is I'm a studio-based beauty and fashion photographer. So I'm primarily shooting exclusively in the studio, where I control the lighting, I control the atmosphere. I have people coming in, do beauty work, do corporate work, do product work. So for like athletic wear companies, magazines, modeling agencies. So it's basically you're either photographing fashion or you're photographing an individual. And that's why I think this show is going to be pretty interesting, because some of the equipment that's going to be discussed is stuff that I could that I would probably be interested in using. So it's really, I would say it's a very specific genre where certain type of equipment is very important. Certain things that maybe a street photographer or a landscape photographer, wouldn't need or doesn't, whereas weight is no big deal for me. Stealthiness is no big deal. So it gives a different side of the photography world.
Yeah. And you mentioned that it's something of a niche, mm-hmm. you're kind of going into a fairly narrow corridor of clients that would be knocking on your door.
Right.
That's not a bad thing. In fact, that's probably a good thing, because if you find that niche and you excel in it,
right,
anybody that needs those services is not going to go to a jack of all trades, master of none photographer that dabbles in this.
Right.
They want somebody who does this full time and does it better than anybody else.
Exactly. Yeah, it's studio based. It's so you have an exclusive type of niche, whereas somebody who say they're a fashion photographer, but if they have a corporate client or they have a brand that they want to shoot, they either rent the equipment or they have to go to a location or they rent a studio. So it does kind of narrow the focus of competition. But at the same time, it's still a very competitive industry. And so there's a very specific type of clientele. And that's basically the game I play in.
Well, I'm thrilled for you. That's awesome. And I know that you and I have had some discussions in the past on film and shooting, right, not just with digital, but film, and having some fun and making, right, that an interesting experience as well. I think we'll have more on that when it comes to the picks of the week.
Absolutely.
I won't steal your thunder there. But let's just dive into the news that we have.
Sure.
there's a few, really heavy hitting stories here, and there's a ton of them actually. And maybe on the next episode, I will discuss some of the additional, smaller stories, because it's all worth covering. There's just only so much we can do in one. Mm-hmm. So our headline story is from Panasonic. They have announced the S1R and the S1 full frame mirrorless cameras. And this is really big news. In fact, I mean, okay, I gotta say, I'm sponsored by Panasonic. I'm one of their Lumix storytellers here in Canada, and I've been using their gear. It's a relatively new sponsorship,
right?
And I'd been using their gear since the winter time in the Micro Four Thirds format, and got some really amazing images that have been definitely print worthy. They've been in galleries. And I love that format for travel. In fact, that's one of the reasons why I was primarily interested. And recently I was traveling overseas in Eastern Europe, and I had their 100 to 400 millimeter lens, which is tiny compared to the 100 to 400 on a full frame camera, with a GX9 and a bunch of other lenses. And I was doing some remarkable stuff that wouldn't have been possible otherwise, because I wouldn't have taken that gear with me traveling. And I've made some prints of that, actually, and I've got more coming up. But Panasonic has pushed the Micro Four Thirds technology to videographers and to photographers and travel and all of that. But it doesn't hit the mark for every photographer, right, that might have different needs, including high resolution, which you are somewhat limited by, right, the number of pixels you can stick on a smaller sensor. And who knows what technology you can build into a bigger system. So they've partnered, and this, I think, is equally as big news. They've partnered with Leica and Sigma. Mm-hmm. So the cameras are going to be using the Leica L mount that Leica has been using for a while. They've had their Leica SL camera. I think it's about 2 years old now, right, that was using this mount. But they had APS-C cameras using the TL lenses, which apparently are fully compatible with the SL camera. Not sure how that applies to Panasonic, but they really lucked out that it was an L mount for Lumix. That's a perfect branding synergy there. Okay, Steve, before I continue on and rattle off specs and everything else, what do you think about this from Panasonic?
I'm impressed. I mean, I think one of the things, and this goes back to what we said from the beginning, I'm a studio photographer and I focus on fashion and beauty. So image size, being full frame, dual SD or typical type of cards, speed of focus is really, really important to me. So size of camera, Micro Four Thirds, it's not that big of a deal. So if you think about the big brands, you talk about the Canons, the Sonys, and you took it the Nikons, this just brings in one additional competitor in the industry. So if you're new to it and don't have an embedded base of Nikon or Canon, this is another choice. And the thing that I really like about it is that I have a Lumix myself, a smaller one, a G7, that I use exclusively for video. The problem is that the still quality of that's not, I mean, it's good, but it's not studio quality. Right. But my clients do sometimes want video. They want high resolution video clips that they can put in their social media. And yet, so I have to go and I have to use two different cameras. What's nice is that the Lumix camera, from what I've read, will give that quality of full frame, quality of image, a lot of pixels, but it'll also have a high quality video too. This is a type of camera that if my current camera line dies on me, it'd be something I'd look at.
Absolutely. And Sigma has announced that they are going to be making lens adapters so that you can put their Sigma lenses into this system, or Canon EF lenses. And I'm sure there are other adapters. I know NovoFlex already makes Canon and Nikon L adapters that would presumably they would work with this. They work with the Leica SL. And I'm just thrilled looking at the specs that they have announced. I mean, in-body image stabilization and in-lens image stabilization as well, which is huge. 47 megapixels on the high resolution versus 24 on the lower resolution. And it's interesting that they say that the S1 is more of a hybrid camera for both photo and video creators.
Right.
The S1R is, I mean, it'll do video. I mean, they're saying they both do 4K 60. But they're saying that the S1R is more for stills. And I guess that kind of makes sense, because if you have a lower resolution sensor, then, you know, you're not going to be using 47 megapixels recording every one of those at 24 frames per second and right. putting that out into a video file. You're going to be confined to, you know, HD, 4K, etc., which is inherently a lower resolution. 4K right. is 8 megapixels or so. So, you know, it's more suited, I guess, for the video task there. And they use the XQD cards, which are, they go up to 400 megabyte per second, read speed or, write speed. And that's very, very fast for video users. I was doing some reading on that format recently, and the successor to all of the current card standards that we have is going to be called CF Express. And as a footnote on the Wikipedia page, the CF Express cards have the exact same footprint and connector as the current XQD cards. Okay. XQDs are based on a PCI Express bus kind of protocol, and the the CF Express memory card format is using the NVMe non-volatile memory express protocol, also on the PCI Express bus, but it gets much, much faster. Mm-hmm. And listening to an interview with Nikon engineers, because they also use the same memory card format, they said that it should be as simple as a firmware upgrade to ensure compatibility across the way. I have no idea if that's true for everybody or what Panasonic is doing. But I prefer that they're using the XQD card versus the CFast format that my current Canon cameras have, which by the look at this announcement, I am selling those Canon cameras.
Yeah, well, you're also doing that because of the recent announcement of the mirrorless camera, right?
Well, yeah. I've been transitioning, of course, to the Micro Four Thirds, but now that this S1R and just looking at the specs that they've announced, and they haven't announced everything. They were very selective as to what features that they have announced, because it is still in prototype form. And some of the samples that they had at Photokina, they didn't even have the faux leather on them yet, because it is still very much a prototype. But from what I can see and what's been announced, this is going to be my next camera. And I'm very excited for that.
Yeah, I really like some of the specs they're talking about with the new Panasonic camera, because if you think about it, so from a studio shooter where I need full frame, it basically checks those boxes. Dual memory card checks those boxes. Fast focus speeds checks those boxes. If you're a sports shooter or you need, you got a young kid that's running around, you know, quickly, it's got the image stabilization, which is really nice.
Yeah, and they haven't said what speed the cameras will shoot at in terms of frames per second and all that. And again, they're probably engineering the firmware to get the most out of it before those specs are even known. They might not even know until they fine tune everything and get it all finalized. So looking at this, though, the other kind of hidden gem in here was Sigma's kind of paired announcement, where they've said, of course, that they will be coming out with a whole series of lenses for the system, in addition to, of course, Panasonic and the probably very expensive Leica lenses. I haven't looked at their prices, but I can almost guarantee multiple thousands of dollars for anything in their lineup. Sigma has also announced that they are abandoning their own SA mount. It is no more. They will still produce some lenses for existing owners of their Quadro cameras.
Quadro, I think.
Yeah. And they are going to transition to using the L mount as well for their future cameras. And they have promised in one of the slides that I had seen from a presentation they put on that they will have a full frame Foveon sensor L mount camera in 2019.
Interesting.
And so the Foveon sensor, are you familiar with that one?
I'm not.
So their sensor technology is different than the color filter arrays that either the Bayer pattern or Fuji uses their own arrangement of colors. The Foveon sensor, instead of having the red, green, and blue as separate photo sites on the sensor itself, they have them stacked on top of each other. So every pixel reads the RGB values independently. So you don't have to do demosaicing to create a colored image. And a lot of professionals in the past have said, you know, that's a wonderful way to do it. There's been problems in terms of resolution and adoption. And it's always been an interesting technology to look at. I've never actually used a Foveon camera, mainly because I looked at my own cameras and the sensors were great. Whatever they're promising is better. It's lacking in resolution or adaptability. It's not going to fit into my workflow. But with Sigma coming on, they are going to be not only producing whatever that new camera is, we have like zero details on it mm-hmm. whatsoever, but they will be offering next year anybody that has the SA mount on their Sigma lenses that they've purchased, you can get that mount changed over to the new L mount. And it's a service that they're going to be offering to help transition their existing user base, which is radical. I mean, to send your lens back to the manufacturer for them to completely change the mount and possibly some of the internal computational stuff, because it's got to talk to an entirely new system. That's bizarre. That's fantastic, but unexpected.
Yeah. Something else.
Yeah. So we live in interesting times. Interview that I had watched with a representative from Panasonic said that they will be ready to present more information to us in early 2019. Mm-hmm. So that's probably when the next wave of information that gives us all the nitty-gritty details. They have announced that there are three lenses, a 50mm f1.4. They didn't mention the exact apertures on the other lenses, we'll be getting 24 to 105, which has always been a workhorse for me on a full-frame camera, and a 70 to 200, which is probably a workhorse in your neighborhood, right?
Yeah, those three lenses at focal length is perfect. I mean, the 50mm, the 85mm range, but a 24 to 105 or a 24 to 70, and then the 70 to 200, that range is what I use all the time. So when I was looking at the specs, I thought, you know, this camera, you could technically replace what I'm currently using and not miss a beat. So it is something that's going to be a camera that I'm going to look at. The other thing too, which is really nice, is that I've looked at the form factor, and the form factor looks really nice too. So it's an impressive looking camera.
I've seen some photos of it placed next to a Sony A7 class body. Mm-hmm. And it looks, at least from the angle of the photo, slightly bigger than an A7. And I'm not sure exactly what the design fundamentals were, but I've been used to using a 1D series body from Canon for a long time. And so I'm no stranger to a big honking camera, especially when I'm doing studio work or most of my macro photography is done right at home. I'm not going to take that gear necessarily traveling. But they've also said, 10 optimized lenses within 1 year of launch. And I gotta say, if you're gonna do this, you have to bring your A game. Yes. You know, and it clearly, every indication is that this is their A game compared to, Canon and Nikon both recently had mirrorless full frame launch announcements. Yeah. And the EOS R is in the hands of a lot of photographers that are testing it out right now. And it's been a mixed bag in terms of the reviews and the feedback that people have been giving. And I think that if that's the case, then you're doing it wrong. I mean, I know some features were unusually absent in the cameras that we were discussing with Steve Brazel on a recent episode, and it's got to just be market segmentation, that they're going to come out with a higher end product, and they don't want to overlap too much within that to steal the sales from people that want the bigger guns. But you know, if you don't bring it all out and lay it out for everybody to say, okay, this is the new camera that you want, that's going to pull you away from what you currently have, then I don't know.
Yeah, but you know, like I said off air, I'm really impressed with what some of the camera manufacturers are doing now. Instead of just launching the next, Mark V or the next D version or the next Nikon D version, DSLR, the next Fuji X version, you're getting something that's really dramatically different. And that's really impressive. I think that says a lot for what's going on in the industry right now.
I think it's the first time that that's happened in a very long time, that we have had such a drastic paradigm shift here from all of the major players. And I guess the writing is on the wall for the old fashioned single lens reflex flapping mirror cameras. I posed it in the last episode that It is likely, and it's just a guess from my perspective, but that the high-end cameras from Canon and Nikon, they probably have one more flagship camera in the pipeline.
Probably.
And that'll probably be the last one.
Yeah, I'm my camera that I have is a, you know, a Nikon DSLR, and I love the thing, but it's probably got another year left on it. And then after that, it's going to be really challenging to decide if I'm going to stay with the same old, same old. Go to a Nikon mirrorless or move to another, you know, camera body. So it's giving professional photographers and amateurs, you know, a lot of decisions to coming up.
Well, exactly. Now I shouldn't poo-poo the Micro Four Thirds system because I right. have gotten some amazing images out of that right. that wouldn't be possible without that form factor.
Exactly.
And even using that form factor for macro photography, you get a perceived magnification increase. Mm-hmm. So a one-to-one macro lens goes much farther than it would on right. a full-frame camera. And Panasonic is not saying, okay, we're switching to full-frame.
Exactly.
These two systems are going to run concurrently. And they also exactly. announced a 10 to 25 millimeter f1.7 continuous aperture zoom lens for the Micro Four Thirds system. And that lens, it just looks like a dream lens to me. I was eyeing their, I think it was a 15 millimeter f1.7 lens, and thinking, well, that would be a nice thing to add to my kit. Well, this is so much more flexible. And uh-huh. yeah, it's probably bigger, but it looks like a very, very fun and well-engineered lens. It's got the Leica branding on it. And it makes total sense for Panasonic to keep both of these lines right. going forever because they're completely different markets. You can have the run and gun videographer that's producing stellar work mm-hmm. on a very small camera, the travel photographer and all of that, that's Micro Four Thirds.
Right.
And then the studio shooter that wants to use a bigger sensor for higher resolution. I have no inside knowledge on this, but if they pack all of the features that they're currently doing on all of their existing cameras, and there's no reason why they wouldn't, then this will be the major competitor, I think, to Sony. I think their market share is going to grow quite quickly, especially if every manufacturer, like Nikon and Canon, everybody else, are making adapters to bring all of their old lenses over to the new format.
Yep.
Well, what if you get an adapter that works equally well on an L mount mm-hmm. and you're not sacrificing anything for that? Those adapters from Nikon would certainly have to be reverse engineered. I don't know what Canon's policy is on that, but I remember reading specifically in it was an engineering interview. I forget exactly. It was on DP Review who had done the interview. But the Nikon engineer said, if anybody wants to make lenses for this system, they're going to have to reverse engineer it, just like they did with the F mount. And I'm thinking, what? Really? You are still... The F mount is how old? And, yeah. and you won't talk to people properly about that? And they have to do their own legwork to make it work? Sure, I guess... That makes sense from a financial point of view, but this L-mount standard, having it open and having at least three players in it right now is great.
No, I think it's a good move. You know, I'm really impressed with what Panasonic's doing. I like everything they're doing with these cameras. And like I said, it's something that for my studio work, it's very tempting.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to the next one, which is also incredibly interesting.
Very interesting.
And this is what Fujifilm is doing mm-hmm. With their medium format cameras, which is quite remarkable. They've made two announcements. One is a product announcement with semi-immediate availability. I think they say November. Mm-hmm. And this is for a 50 megapixel, the GFX 50R, which is a range finder style of camera. And it's got, lots of buttons and knobs and switches for a photographer to enjoy, but it's in a smaller format. And its price point is the key discussion here, I think.
Right.
$4,499 US.
Right.
So you can get a medium format 50 megapixel camera for $4,500.
Exactly.
Now, that still is a lot of money for somebody looking to buy into a new camera system. But what if you buy into that, you get a bunch of lenses, and you know you're going to spend more on a higher megapixel or a better camera later on? It's a great entry point, especially 2-3 years from now mm-hmm. when these are on the used market and you knock $1,000 or $2,000 off of them. It makes it so approachable to jump into the medium format digital world with one of these little guys.
What I like about it is that it's got a rangefinder view form factor, So it very much follows the X line, you know, form factor, which is very, very typically, you know, a street photographer's camera.
Yeah.
And, you know, I like the look of the camera. I would love to have a medium format digital for my studio work, but, you know, the prices tend to be a little bit outside of my budget.
Exactly.
Yeah. And this one, the price looks good. The form factor looks good. You could use, for somebody like me that does street photography too, it could be used out on the street. I don't know if you need that many megapixels for just everyday street work, but it's a, I just love the form factor, and, you know, it just plays right along what Fuji's done with their 50S, but puts it into a different form factor. You know, the only, you know,
I don't think I'd ever really need medium format. There's a certain allure there. I mean, maybe that's because I like medium format film cameras because they're so right. tactile and big, and they have a sense of presence. And so that format, especially a different aspect ratio, is interesting to play with. If I need resolution, well, clearly it's easy to get the same resolution in a full frame camera. Mm-hmm. Yes, there's smaller pixels. There's tons of caveats within that. But the feel that so many people claim medium format is all about doesn't really hit the mark on any of the work that I do. So it's interesting at 50 megapixels, and for some entire industries, like you mentioned, anything from street photography to fashion work, mm-hmm. This could be a very useful piece of kit.
It is. And again, I always go back to what I do. And, you know, you're talking about DSLRs and you're talking about medium format. That's the industry that I'm in. So to a certain extent, there's a little bit of if somebody comes in with a Micro Four Third and it may be just as good, you know, you get these little chuckles every once in a while from clients and other yep. photographers and the Digitechs and, you know, the makeup artists. They'll look at somebody who brings in a small little camera that, again, it could make amazing images. But it's a certain, oh, okay, you're not a real photographer.
Yeah, you know, so to size matters for your first impression, right? You know, they're not judging you based on your skills as a photographer. They're judging you based on the size of your camera.
Yeah, it's to a certain extent, it's looks to some clients, all right? And so if you were to come in with a, like a GFX 50S, you know, the typical form factor, medium format camera that Fujifilm makes, that gives an impression. But for somebody like me who has an established portfolio, an established base of clients, the camera doesn't matter. But having a medium format form factor, or medium format those extra megapixels, is important because a lot of times, especially with beauty work, you know, I'm cropping way down. I'm editing at the pixel level. You know, it's all about getting things perfect in many cases.
What is the resolution of your camera right now?
43.
And so you would like more?
Correct. And so what I do is I convert that to a TIFF, which is, you know, of course, makes it huge. But, you know, every pixel is important for my work. So as an example, when I'm shooting, I do what I call shoot to crop. So let's say you're going to have a, you know, you need a little bit of space above it because it's going to be in a magazine and you need something mm-hmm. for text, you're going to shoot it that way. But if you're not going to shoot to crop and you just want to focus on the top of the outfit, you're going to shoot it. So all you're seeing is the top of the outfit because you want as many megapixels just focusing on what you're going to use.
Yeah. Well, and especially too, because when you are editing on that pixel level, mm-hmm. it might not be used at that resolution, but you don't want your edits to be obvious.
Exactly.
And so if you were to then shrink that down, the more information you have to start with makes those edits more transparent in the final product.
Exactly. And so, you know, it's just one part of it, but it is something that in the industry that I'm in, not the street side, but in the beauty and the fashion work, the size of the sensor, the megapixels, and the quality of the pixels is very important. And so medium format for me is very interesting. However, because of the cost of the cameras today, you know, I personally can't afford to get, you know, a big $50,000 camera.
Well, that's phase one has, they just announced some 150 megapixel cameras that right. I think they had a $55,000 price tag associated with that to get a camera with no lens, of course.
Right.
And what's interesting is Fuji is kind of taking them to task as well right. Because they've announced the development and they showed a prototype at Photokina. of a 100 megapixel medium format camera with phase detection and in-body image stabilization. Mm-hmm. And they're claiming it will not only be 4K capable, so it's going to do video as well, but it's going to sell for around $10,000, which seems like a big number, but it's a heck of a lot smaller than 55,000.
Yes. Yeah. No, I think this is a good move. I think it's a natural progress, a natural step for Fuji. You know, it for me, when I first saw it, I thought it was going to be an X-line camera, just the way it looked. Mm-hmm. You know, for somebody who has some money and they do street photography, this would be a good step up. If for somebody like myself that does both street work and fashion work, a camera like this could be a good dual camera. So mm-hmm. I think it's worth a look.
If I were to spend, and I remember spending around $7,000 or $8,000 Canadian, mind you, on the 1DX Mark II, and I bought it right at launch. And it's that is the at launch price of a flagship camera from Canon or Nikon.
Right.
And so if you figure that in, it's like, okay, well, 7,000 is pretty close to 10. I mean, it's within the same ballpark. You're going to be spending $3,000 more for a system that offers you a lot of different potential if that's useful for you. And it used to be that medium format. I mean, the cost was just the big deciding factor. I mean, it's more expensive than both of our cars combined. Mm-hmm. That's, you can't just break into that. But now with a lower end camera body, especially in a couple of years when you can get them less expensive, this is going to, start the adoption of it. And if people get invested in lenses, then they just continue with that system. It's the same thing that Fuji did with their X series cameras. And that's what Panasonic is doing, with their new S series of cameras. Right. And so once you get invested into that system, you know, you're going to want to stay. And I think that everybody that is coming out with new formats and systems here, they are going to have to capitalize on the fact that people that are shooting the flapping mirror cameras from Canon and Nikon, they are going to be buying mirrorless cameras in the future. They are going to jump into a totally new system, and you have to catch them then.
Yep. Yeah. Because honestly, I'm in a cycle. People like myself are in a cycle for purchasing. So right now, like I said, I've got to buy another year on my camera body, and then I have to make a decision. And so if it's easy to migrate, you know, if the lenses, I can get good mounts, if I can get good adapters, there's nothing that says that I have to get an existing body that I have today. And so mirrorless is very attractive to me. Medium format's very attractive to me. So this opens up a whole lot of other options that I wouldn't have even considered even a year ago.
Yeah.
One question I do have about the Fujifilm, though, is we talk about the price, but that's just for the body, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, you won't get a lens with that.
Yeah. Now, I don't know what kit lens, if they have one, will come with it, but the GF lenses are not the cheapest lenses in the world. So
no, but was it Venus Optics with their Laowa lens lineup? They've just announced a lens for the GFX platform. So if third-party manufacturers come on, especially something that are making less expensive, truly mechanical lenses, at least it gives you an option to start with.
Yeah, and if you're doing street, having a mechanical lens is no problem at all.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, it's interesting too, because when I saw this announcement from Panasonic, I got to thinking, okay, well, I mean, what are the possibilities for me to experiment with? One of the things that I've done a lot with is 3D photography, which, very few people are doing, and I'm having a lot of fun with that. And I've got the new Red Hydrogen phone that has a no glasses required 3D display. So I just on a whim found a ridiculously inexpensive deal on a Leica Stemar lens, which is a stereo Elmar from, I think, 1954 is when it was made. And it's designed for the M mount. So I've got that now on order, and an adapter from the M mount to the L mount so that I can use the stereo camera. I couldn't use it on a Canon camera because it has this protrusion that goes into the main body of the camera to separate both eyes, very cleanly, a dividing line, half the image for the left eye, half the image for the right eye. And so a camera with a mirror and a mirror box inside, it would be incompatible with. You wouldn't be able to physically pair them together. So now I've got another toy that I'm going to have some fun with. Those lenses usually show up on eBay for like $4,000 or $5,000. I got it for significantly less than that. So hopefully it's not broken.
Wow.
Oh, the toys we play with.
Yes.
Speaking of toys and play, the final story here is something that I've known about for a little while because I have a something of a partnership with On One, and I'm so glad that I can finally talk about what they are working on with the On One Photo Raw 2019 software. It was also announced in line with Photokina. And I'm not sure if you watched any of the videos that they had for it, or if you just read the press release, Steve.
Right.
But they are very seriously knocking on Adobe's door and saying, "Hey, you know, everybody inside this party, we got a better one across the street."
Right.
And so, anybody that is currently using Lightroom, they will now be able to migrate all of their images directly over to On One with a, they say it's an AI process to figure out exactly how the settings match from one set of sliders to another because they are not synonymous with each other.
Right.
In fact, I've liked the way that On One handles its highlight slider because it only affects the highlights, whereas in Lightroom or Camera Raw, the highlight slider affected much more of the histogram than just the highlights.
Just the highlights.
It went into the mid-tone. So they found a way to match things up almost exactly, which will allow you to take everything that you have into On One Photo Raw. And what do you think about this?
I think it's good. Look, photographers like myself have a love-hate relationship with Lightroom and Photoshop, or Capture One and Photoshop. It is the industry standard. Photoshop is what's used. You know, Lightroom is used for street photography, Lightroom and Photoshop for fashion and beauty work. It is a necessary tool. It's just as important as our camera and our equipment. But Adobe does not make it easy to be a client of Adobe. we could have a whole podcast just about some of the challenges of working with Lightroom and Photoshop, but it is a necessary tool. The problem is today, there is no alternative. There are alternatives that will fit one niche or might do part of this or part of that, but there's no suite that can replace it. And when I was reading this press release, it sounds like they're saying all the right things.
They are. You know, they've got a portrait mode in there, which kind of has a lot of the sliders that you might find in Photoshop for that kind of stuff. I'm not sure exactly how it will all shake out. But those functionalities are being added. They're adding focus stacking
right
into the software, which is something that Lightroom can't do. You would have to go to Photoshop, and not even Photoshop Elements, the full version, or use Arene Stacker or Helicon Focus, other software that's dedicated to focus stacking. But they're building that right into this software, and I can't wait to get my hands on a beta build when they're available and testing that, because that is going to be the game changer. That means that, you know, my previous workflow for doing that in macro photography would be to select all of my images in Lightroom, send them to Photoshop. Photoshop does the heavy lifting for the focus stacking. And then I can deal with my cloning and whatever else that I need to do. If I can do that all in one place without having to go anywhere else, then sold. You know, I can leave Lightroom behind.
Yeah, I think that for a large portion of the photography community, something that's an alternative to a subscription-based platform that is a Lightroom-based product for your cataloging and for some minor enhancements, or your big heavy lifting with Photoshop, if that could be combined into one tool so you don't have to round trip, that's a very, very viable alternative. And what I liked about the press announcement is that they did talk about, you know, it's non-destructive, so that's very important. They talked about masking, some AI masking, which is critical because on every image that I edit, there's just tons and tons and tons of masking done. And if there was something that could be done to make it quicker, if there's more intelligence behind it, I'm all for that. I think so on the things that I'd want to know about is a little bit about, can it tether? Because for me, tethering is very important. And
I don't know. I've never actually, because I don't tether. It's not a feature that's on my radar.
Yeah. I mean, it's not critical, but it is something that, that's one thing that Lightroom does offer, is it has the tether functionality. I would want to know how they keep up with some of the raw engine changes. So if a new camera comes up, because this is not a subscription service, if they're going to keep it updated. So if I buy a new camera, that's really critically important. But the most important thing, and I think that they are saying the right things, is that the thing that keeps me away from moving to another alternative is the pain to migrate. So I have 10 years worth of images that have been maintained in Lightroom and then edited in Photoshop.
I've got about 750,000 images over about the same time period.
Yep.
And it has to be, okay, let's just feed it the Lightroom catalog and everything is now in place in this new environment. Exactly. And it seems like they're doing that.
Like minor tweaks, slightly different. That's okay because most of my finished images are saved in TIFF files anyway.
Same here.
But bottom line is that if let's say the last year or the last 6 months, and I'm still working on some of those work, some of those images for clients, and I'm migrating to On1, and all of a sudden I lose all my flags, I lose all my sliders, I lose all my camera profiles, I'm devastated. So that's something that if they can prove to the community that that's something they can do as a migration, this is a really, it looks like a really good option to move away from, you know, the Adobe products. And don't get me wrong, Adobe products are good.
I use them every day. It's a love-hate relationship though.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think this is really good. They're saying everything that I love to hear.
And some very innovative things too, compared to what Lightroom and Photoshop would be. Because whenever you send a photo out of Lightroom, it's no longer raw data. It's been demosaicked. It's sent as a 16-bit TIFF to Photoshop or any plugins. You're no longer dealing with raw data. It comes back in as a TIFF file.
Right.
Whereas in the demo video that they were showing off, they had an image with some fish in a little pond. And they were overlaying multiple images as layers, and they were layers of raw data. Each one of them, you could go back and move all the raw sliders. It's all going back to the core of the raw processor at the end of that. And they were changing the blending modes to make more fish show up by changing the blending mode to lighten. And I'm thinking, if all of that is done with raw data, it hasn't been sent out anywhere else. They've got a very powerful engine under the hood in order to compute all of that. And that's what I want, because if I can do as much as possible with raw data before having it sent out to a final format, the better, rather than, you know, after your first wave of edits in Lightroom, then now you're no longer dealing with raw data anymore. I don't think that's the right approach.
Yeah. You know, the other thing that I really like is the fact that it's not a subscription based product.
Which, they do have a subscription, they've got On1 Plus, and I was their guest coach for a month this year in June. And so there's added value in that environment. But if you want to buy a standalone product, and you just, no strings attached, you just get a perpetual license, it's yours and yours forever, it's there.
Correct, which is one of the big drawbacks for Adobe is that if you just want to use their tools, you have to get the subscription service. It's just, I know it's their business model and photographers do it, but I like the option of being able to buy something and it's mine now.
Yeah. And I do know some of the under the hood stuff that they've been working on. When I first experimented with On1 Photo Raw, I've got a couple of nice cherry picked images to show how much data you can pull out of a raw file. And I would demo them in Photoshop or Lightroom where, the sky is almost completely blown out and the foreground is almost in shadow. But if you do the right adjustments, you can bring that all back in.
Right.
And in previous versions of the On1 software, if you were to use a local adjustment, it was not basing that adjustment on the raw data. It was basing it as on some intermediate processed version. And so if I adjust the raw data to recover the shadows, and then I tried to bring the highlights back down with a local adjustment, the highlights were gone. They weren't there, even though they are in the original raw data. Now it's all there. And I'm sure they needed to adjust their algorithms to match Lightroom for bringing in Lightroom stuff. And that was one of the, I don't want to say a point of weakness, but you know, it's something that they could definitely improve on. And oh boy, they have. And so we're looking forward to seeing how all that comes together in this new version. It's exciting times photographically, both on the hardware and on the software side. Once this is out, I'm going to give it a test. And, you know, obviously supply them with some feedback. But I've got a feeling it's going to replace Lightroom for me. It might not entirely replace Photoshop for everything that I need Photoshop to do, because there's lots of weird stuff in Photoshop. But Lightroom is probably going to disappear from my desktop.
Yeah, I think another thing too is that it has to be pretty intuitive, because even though Photoshop is very, very difficult to learn, most people that have used it for a number of years, they have their own little tweaks, little shortcuts. Their actions have already been set up. They've bought presets. You know, it's already set up for them. So the learning curve is probably very, very steep for somebody first getting into Photoshop. So if the product could be introduced, the On1 product could be introduced, and it has a smaller learning curve, it would be easier for people like me to transition. So I'm very excited about this. As soon as a beta version is available, I'm going to try to get my hands on it. And
I can hook you up, I'm sure.
Give it a try.
But, you know, in this scenario, you know, I want to spend less time editing. I want to spend less time in front of the computer doing monotonous, tedious work, because that's what editing really is for the most part. Unless you're like in total Zen mode with a landscape photograph dodging and burning while you're listening to your favorite band, it still isn't even what I want to do.
Right. No, and you know, for myself, I do, the way I always say this in my profession, it's 25% preparation, planning, getting everything set up, 25% shooting, you know, actually in front of the client or behind the camera, and 50% editing. And that editing, if it's a client that, you know, there's some bad skin or you've got a lot of lighting issues, it's drudgery. And so if you have a tool that doesn't make it easy for you, it adds to the drudgery. So anything that makes that 50% easier, faster, more enjoyable, I'm on board.
I will say too, though, if something is drudgery, but I get better results with it,
yes,
sometimes I'll suffer through that, because at the end of the day, I want to be that 2% better than somebody else. And again, that's that love and hate relationship again.
No, and I say that with kind of tongue in cheek, because I enjoy the process, but if I would rather be in front of the camera.
Exactly.
Or behind the camera, sorry. I enjoy the photographic part of it. And I realize that the editing is something that needs to be done. But if I could shorten that period so that I could spend more time taking the photograph or interacting with the client and less time editing, that's what I would like to do.
You and me are in the same boat. I mean, I don't, you know, photograph clients and things like that. My work is different, but if I can be in my studio, which is just on the other side of my office, and if I could spend an entire day just tinkering with an idea that I've had and, you know, stepping stones of mistakes and failures that I'm reveling in as I'm solving problems and evolving that idea into something new and interesting, that's where I'm happy as a photographer. That's where my passions overlap with my profession. And I want more of that time. Please give me the ability to spend less time here at this desk.
Yes, exactly.
As much as I love talking about it and recording these podcasts and everything, this desk is known to me as a stressful place.
I know.
Oh boy. Okay. So let's get into our picks of the week. I think it's about time we do that. My pick is one that I've had for a while and a number of years, and it hasn't failed me. It has worked flawlessly. And if you shoot with the ridiculous amount of flash that I do, especially in the wintertime when I'm doing my snowflakes and my ring flash will chew through batteries very quickly, you need a way to charge your batteries fast. Mm-hmm. Most battery chargers on the market have 4 or maybe 6 on the outset, 8 possible charging ports to charge batteries. Well, I found one that has 16. And it works really well. It gives you an LCD screen readout on how much each battery is charged. And it surprisingly comes with both a wall plug and a car plug with USB ports on the side of it as well. I use it with the Eneloop Pro batteries and it is quite remarkable. So this is Titanium Innovations, a company you've never heard of before. I don't even know what else they make. This is the only thing that I found from them. It is the MD1600L. Sure. Whatever, that's just the model name. This thing, I just bought another one recently because I'm going to have some upcoming time-lapse projects where I might have a lot of batteries constantly going in cycles. And it came exactly the same way, wall charger and car charger. And it's solid. If you need a battery charger, and anybody with a camera with flash anyhow probably needs a battery charger,
definitely
pick this one up, because it works exceptionally well, handles high volume, and gives you a perfect readout and lets you know if there's any issues with any specific battery not charging properly.
No, definitely I'm going to get one, because I use Ellen Loops all the time, and I go through them quite a lot with, you know, for the triggers in the studio and for some small flashes that I use occasionally.
Yeah, it's $60 on Amazon. It's not a terrible expense.
And it seems like all the batteries go dead at once. And so I've got this 1-4 battery charger, and I'm just, it was like, oh my gosh, you know, it takes so much time to recharge these things. So if I could put them all in at once, that'd be outstanding.
There you go. I've spent some money for you. And I think you're about to spend some of mine with your pick of the week.
I am. I'm going to, my pick of the week is, goes back in time a little bit. So, for your listeners, I also do a lot of film work. So everything that I do outside of the studio, I shoot with film. So all my street work is with film, all casual work that I do is film. And film, for those of people who've been out of it for a number of years, has made a huge resurgence in the last couple of years. A lot of new film manufacturers have come up. And I'm talking about 35mm film. So the original full frame. Right. And so just recently, Kodak relaunched one of its T-Max films, the black and white.
3200, right?
3200, right. Yeah. Well, they're just now launching, reintroducing Ektachrome.
Right.
So Ektachrome is being launched immediately, so distributors can start placing orders right away.
Before we started recording, I checked on B&H. It's not there yet, but I'm sure give it a day or two, and it'll be available from your favorite photo store.
Right. I would say by this time next week or week following, it'll be available. And for those of you that are not familiar with it, Ektachrome is a reversal film. So
slide film.
Correct. It's slide film. So instead of being a negative, it's a positive. And so it's also a little bit different in how it's developed. It's using E6 chemistry. And there's a few labs here in the United States and around the world that develop it.
You develop your own E6, don't you?
I do. So I develop all my own film. It's not that hard, really. It takes no time at all. But what's nice is that the color, the saturation, the color rendition with slide film tends to be a little bit nicer than with negative film. So I've really, really interested in this. And I still have about 100 rolls.
You got to start burning through the stuff you got.
Dude, I've kept this in the refrigerator for years. This stuff still works.
I've got some Provia 400 in the refrigerator right now.
Oh, lucky guy.
That's in medium format, though. And 400 ISO slide film, I don't know if we'll see that again.
No. But they are talking about launching this not only in 35mm, but 120. Because there's still...
I haven't heard any talks about that, but I want that in 120 in medium format.
The other thing that's really critically important is that Kodak is also going to be launching its Ektachrome version of Super 8 film in the next...
And 16mm too. But I gotta ask, Steve, who's using that?
It's making a big resurgence.
Really?
Millimeter film.
I can't imagine... Can't you get exactly that same look in post? Why would you shoot with the lowest, crummiest resolution format for video possible?
Because it looks low quality. It looks like something when you were 5 years old and your dad walked around with a Super 8 camera. That's what it looks like.
when I was 3 years old, he was an electronics repair technician, and he got a broadcast Betamax camera in his studio when he was, you know, fixing it. And for my third birthday, he recorded my third birthday on a broadcast Betamax, like $100,000 camera. So when I look at my home videos from back then, it was no Super 8, I tell you.
I know. No, what's interesting is that it just shows, you know, if somebody's willing to buy a medium format Fujifilm camera, that's a very niche market. There are people out there that are buying, that are getting back into Super 8.
Kodak had their hybrid digital / Super 8 camera that I don't know if it ever did come to market. They had shown off prototypes of it. And I don't remember seeing a price tag of it or anybody using it in the wild. But that was also shocking to me that you would have an LCD screen, you would get a perfect readout of everything, but the actual recording medium was Super 8 film.
Right, right. Well, the thing that's really interesting too is that they're not making new film cameras. I mean, there's a few niche companies that are making film cameras, but we're talking about cameras that have been around since, you know, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s. These are cameras, but they're still reintroducing film because there's that embedded base of cameras, embedded base of people who want to use it. So,
and a lot of photographers like myself, I came into this in the digital world,
right?
But film has a certain nostalgia that I never got to experience it during the film era because I wasn't a photographer then. And so why not just see what it was all about? And yeah, you know what? It can be a little bit hipster at times. And it does have that kind of vibe. I'm not going to go and start typing on a typewriter anytime soon. There is one behind me in my office. That's another story. But the concept of this reintroduction of film is beautiful because Kodak knows it's never going to be a huge market. No. It is growing just like vinyl records are growing.
Right.
But it will, they're building this on a sustainable footprint, I think, where they know it's going to be small. They can produce this in lower volume. Whereas at the heyday of Kodak, when film started to decline, the overhead that they had was completely unsustainable. And so you had Fuji, Ilford, Kodak, you name the film companies, all just scrapping the marginal products because they just weren't selling enough of these unusual scientific films and things like that.
Yeah, this is a product of love. I mean, you're not going to make tons of money. Kodak's not going to make huge runs of this anymore. They're not going to have huge factories for these type of products. This is really, truly a niche. But the one thing that's important, if you're interested in film or you're just getting into it, digital is easier. Digital is faster. You can make more mistakes with digital than with film. You can see results immediately with digital. I'm here to tell you that the quality of a digital image is generally going to be better than the quality of a film image. However, there's something about shooting on film that is unique. It slows you down. You get to look at your image differently. You look at the scene differently. And what's nice is that you do have main companies like Kodak that realize that, and they're supporting the industry. So the reintroduction of a slide film by Kodak, I think, is says quite a lot about the film industry. And so if you have any interest, it's going to be available in the store pretty soon.
Yeah. And, you know, if you have an old film camera, and if you don't, you can get one for a few dollars.
For nothing.
Just pick up a roll of film. Doesn't have to be Ektachrome, could be anything. No. And just shoot a roll of film. If you've never done that as a photographic experience, I think that it is well worth it because the knowledge or just the value of that experience will add to you as a photographer.
Oh, no question about it.
Yeah. And actually, Steve, while I have you on here, Silbera, did you ever receive any film from them?
I did. I've worked with Silbera and contacted the owners when they first started up. And so I did get several of their rolls of film and still have some. And it's really quite nice. So they've kind of gone off the radar screen because they've had some problems with distribution out of their manufacturing plant.
Because I know they did a Kickstarter campaign, and I pitched in for some medium format film from them. And I get the weird occasional update kind of saying that we're struggling, but everything is going to happen. We are, you know, putting our hearts and souls into this. But I don't know. And so they had a Kickstarter campaign to launch a number of black and white film emulsions. These guys are based in Russia, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so to have these companies, it sucks that they're struggling. But you know, I want them to have that international success. I want any film company. There was Berger, which was Italy, I think.
No, it's French.
French. Who was the other one from Italy?
Film Ferrania.
Yes, that's the
Film
one.
Ferrania, FOMA. There's several that did Kickstarters, and some of them been successful, some of them have not. Film Ferrania is still in the production stage, still some delays. So some films have done well, some have not.
And, you know, I've got some rolls of Rolei Variochrome here, if we're talking about slide film. I don't know where this thing came from because it was a limited run. Right. That somebody had like left an emulsion behind somewhere, right. And it was just like
just repackaged.
Yeah, just repackaged for it. But who was making slide film? Because nobody was. I mean, if it was something from Fuji, then they would have, you know, claimed ownership of it. So who made like a production run of slide film and then just left it somewhere to rot?
I think it was probably in some industrial freezer someplace, and somebody bought it and had it repackaged and put it into a cool look. And so there's a couple of companies that do that where they just get a film stock and they repackage it and sell it, and people like me buy it.
Yeah, and well, clearly me too. although I, you know, you shoot more film than I do. I really want to get out and do more of it. I got to get some interesting film cameras. So final question on that pick. You get a new roll of Ektachrome. What camera does it go in?
I just loaded one expired roll into a Pentax K1000, and I'll probably put it in my Canon AE-1.
The AE-1, a classic. I have one of those as well. Yeah. Cool. Well, thanks for that pick, Steve, and a fun little discussion on film towards the end of, you know, we started off with the latest and the greatest pushing of digital technology, and we end with the joy of film. It's a very interesting discussion.
The original full frame.
Exactly. Well, and I am very serious. If you have any hints that they are going to push out a 120, which is medium format, for Ektachrome, I would be very interested in that, because I've got a medium format stereo camera. Right. I need to feed that beast. I need to, and I've got a viewer. It's like a ViewMaster, but on steroids, because it actually it holds the 6x6 centimeter slides as the ViewMaster view. And if you look at something shot in stereo through that, it's like you're standing right there. It is such a wonderful experience, but getting good slide film is harder and harder.
It is. And 120 is a big market still. So I think that we'll see.
We'll see.
We're waiting for that 35 millimeter. I'm going to buy some as soon as it comes out on the shelf.
Perfect. Now, I like to end the episodes when I remember to ask, what's the next thing for you? I mean, you're passionate about photography in so many ways, but what are you most excited to pick up your camera and shoot?
Well, kind of a personal, you know, bucket list thing and kind of a documentary thing. So next February, I'm going to be riding my bicycle across the United States. So I've been training all summer, and I'm going to take a couple of film cameras and be documenting it with film. So the idea is that every time I stop someplace, I'm going to take document it with film. So hopefully take a little video camera with me too, and just shoot film across the United States.
Sounds awesome. You've got to like slap a GoPro on your bike and just have it record the entire thing and play that back as a time lapse.
Yeah, it'll put people asleep after about 5 minutes.
No, you condense it down to 30
seconds. I know. No, I've got a GoPro mount on my bike, so we'll see.
Right. Awesome. And for me, geez, I don't even know what I'm doing next. I barely have my head on straight for all the projects that I have going on. I'm doing some canvas production work for some clients right now, and that's really interesting. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be out in Calgary at the Camera Store and doing a recording for DP Review TV.
Nice.
And that's going to be in the first week of October. It's going to be fun.
A really nice job up there.
Oh yeah, they're wonderful guys. I haven't met them personally, but I'm very excited to be there. And I want to pick up some ideas that I've had for years and just find the time to run with them.
Yeah,
like I had an idea to photograph the Earth inside of a water droplet, and I executed that idea pretty well. You can just use NASA's public domain archives to get a printed map of the Earth, and then put that in behind a water droplet, and lo and behold, the Earth is inside the droplet. But I've had the idea for the longest time to make the Earth spin inside the droplet on video. And it's not hard to do. It's just a logistical challenge where I take the map and I print it in repetition, and I have the camera on a tripod with continuous light, and I just pull the map in behind the droplet, and it will appear to rotate inside the droplet itself. Right. I've had that idea for 4 years, Steve.
So you're going to do it tonight?
I don't think I've got the time to do it tonight. I hear my daughter, who's 2 years old, screaming upstairs, so I have to go and be a team player after we're done recording this.
Yeah.
But at the very least, we should say to everybody out there listening, thank you so much for getting through another episode. It's time to get out and shoot.